put them down!
There's quite a piece of game theory in medieval combat, which is if you're wealthy enough, it's probably worth not killing you. If you were an ordinary soldier and you captured a duke or something, then your family would be set for life.
Kill them where they stand!
Hello, you're listening to Hey Lesson, the podcast where we underhandedly teach you things through the lens of popular video games. And we do that by chatting to experts in science, history, and in a bunch of other topics as well. I'm your host, Brendan Caldwell, and today we're going to be talking about medieval wargame Chivalry 2, which is a chaotic multiplayer battlefield where you don a knight's armor, or some other armor sometimes, to clash swords, launch catapults, maybe throw an axe at your friend's head, who knows. But what was war and life really like for an armored knight of the medieval period? We will be talking to a modern day knight, a jouster, and a medievalist in just a moment to learn more about the codes of chivalry. But first, let's see who's with us in the saddle this episode. Oh, look, it's journalist and seasoned warrior of many a virtual battlefield, Matt Cox. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
How you doing?
Pleasure to be here. Yeah, I'm good.
We've played a nice chunk of this game, Chivalry 2, together. So you're pretty well decorated as a swordsman, right? Mm.
We've stabbed many people side by side.
We have saved each other's from many a scoundrel, many a knave, and also we've arrived just after our friend has been killed.
In fact, my main experience of playing Chivalry 2 with you is you saying, "Oh, Matt, oh, Matt," as people surround me, and you worry for my safety, which a lot of the time you're correct to do.
But it's fun because you get into a lot of scrapes out there, and I'm usually hanging back playing the objective, and you just swan out with a big giant halberd and just go to town. Mm-hmm. And it's nerve wracking to watch.
You gotta be brave.
Let's do what we always do at the top of the show, which is explain the game a little before we go too deeply into it. So that people know what we're talking about. What is Chivalry 2? You know, what does it look like? What are you doing it?
It's basically a big medieval battlefield simulator. So you're one of several classes. You might be the person that can carry big swords and run fast. You might be a kind of slower, more tanky knight, or someone that sits in between those things, or a cowardly archer.
We're going to talk about the archers certainly soon. It's like a first person shooter. It's like Battlefield, but you don't get a gun. You just get a big mace.
Yeah. A big part of it is the spectacle of up to 64 people on your side battering away at 64 people on the other side, which you can imagine is quite a good sense of scale.
It's 32 people on one side, 32 people on the other side.
That is correct.
Right?
I have said the wrong numbers there, but I don't think anybody noticed.
We'll get 64 versus 64 when the new Battlefield Future War comes out, but that's for another episode of Hey Lesson.
Nevertheless, the point is there is an overwhelming number of men with swords and women with swords.
Yep. I'm going to ask you a bit more about the game and what you think of it and how it compares to others like it, maybe. We'll do that in a moment, but for now, let's do a learn, because you can play as a knight in armor in this game. That's one of the classes. But we wanted to know what warfare for a medieval knight was really like. What kind of duties did a knight have? How did people even become knights? So I spoke to Jason Kingsley. He is a jouster and a massive medieval history buff who runs the Modern History TV channel on YouTube. He's also the CEO of Rebellion, which is a big games publisher in the UK. But we're talking to him with his medieval hat on, his steel helmet. So here's what he had to tell us. So could you please introduce yourself? Firstly, who are you and what do you do?
My name's Jason Kingsley. I'm the CEO and creative director of Rebellion. But I also have a professional standard hobby, which is the medieval environments and my own YouTube channel called Modern History TV. I actually train and practice in armor on horses for real. and I fight in real tournaments, and I do real jousting.
I'm not too sure, but I think you're also a knight, technically.
Well, I am. Her Majesty the Queen granted me an OBE after my name, so I'm an officer of the Order of the British Empire, which is a level of chivalric honour. It doesn't technically allow me to use the term sir before my name. You have to level up to get that.
Take a moment to collect yourself. Soon you will be strewn across this battlefield.
Could you maybe tell me what was expected of a knight in the medieval period? What were their duties?
A knight started out as an elite fighting man. That role became a leadership role. Most knights had their own land. They had what's called a knight's fee, which varied in size, with a piece of land which varies from about 300 acres all the way up to thousands of acres, depending on the quality of the land. There's no standard sort of area. The idea of a knight's fee was that it was the area of land run by teams of people who are called peasants. That doesn't mean they're necessarily incredibly poor. They worked the land. They were subsistence farmers largely, but also they created an excess. And the idea was that that group of people could supply a knight and a knight's retinue to fight.
Bow before your better.
So were there a lot of knights at that time, or was it a very, very rare thing to get that role?
It wasn't rare, and it was fairly hereditary. It wasn't always hereditary. You could be knighted by somebody. Knighthood was granted by another knight until Henry VIII said, no, it can only be granted by the king, and that was largely because he could then tax people and take a fee from them. So knighthood, in some cases, somebody laughingly described it to me as a bit like vampirism. You get made into a knight by another knight. It varied. It varies in places. So, for example, if you go to the Holy Roman Empire, in what is now Germany, for example, there were a lot more knights per head of the population, but they were much poorer. They often had smaller areas of land. Where you go to somewhere like Burgundy, the Low Countries, again, mainland Europe, was very wealthy, and you had people there who actually had suits of armour that were fully gilded, so the whole thing was covered in gold. They would have looked a bit like C-3PO. On the battlefield, but literally covered in gold. And in some cases, they had jewels and, expensive other metals on their helmets. So knights in the later period were not exactly subtle to display their wealth.
You can't spell awesome without me.
Knights would typically be part of a team. You would have a lance, literally a free lance, with the knight, the heavy cavalryman at the front in the heavy armor, usually two to four supporting more lightly armed cavalry, and often foot soldiers, specialists. So you might have in the English armies, you might have each knight would have a minimum of two longbowmen and two men at arms on the ground. So a knight was really like an officer class, as we would think of it today in the army.
It's sort of like a squad leader.
Literally that. Like a Formula One driver today can't do it all himself. He doesn't change his own tyres. He doesn't tune his engine. He doesn't fuel his own car. He or she has a massive team of experts around them. And a knight was the same.
Surround the enemy. Let them see nothing but our steel at all sides.
Are there any downsides to becoming a knight in that era, apart from having to die on the battlefield, of course?
Well, dying on the battlefield was one thing, although knights typically, they did die on the battlefield, but generally speaking, the idea was that you captured them and ransomed them. There's quite a piece of game theory in medieval combat, which is if you're wealthy enough, it's probably worth not killing you, which is why guns were frowned upon, because the guns were incredibly inaccurate, but would kill people. And that was considered to be quite unsporting. But usually by the nobility, who considered it to be unsporting to be killed by peasants, not the other way around. The other way around was perfectly acceptable. You were allowed to kill peasants in the dozens, but nobility you were not supposed to kill.
Grovel, that you may know mercy.
But were there any other kind of downsides that were maybe like more mundane?
Oh yes, absolutely. You had to pay high rate of tax. You had to pay a high rate of tax, and as a result of being a knight, you also had to provide yourself and four armed men to garrison one of the king's castles. And interestingly, sometimes you could hold the knighthood, but you could pay other people to do what's called your knight's services. So you would pay what's called scutage. And increasingly, as the medieval period rolls on, you find people who are knights are not really that keen on fighting. And a lot of knights didn't really have the training or the wanting to fighting. And of course, the king wanted good fighting men. And the king said, well, look, you're bloody rubbish on the battlefield. Just pay me money and I'll hire some men to fight instead. There's quite a lot of them that clearly don't really want to go on the battlefield. And you can't blame them because medieval battlefields were horrible, horrible places.
You live. Now I have more important things to attend to.
This game that we're playing, it's called Chivalry, but it's quite dishonorable. There's no real courtesy given between fighters on the battlefield. It's very ruthless most of the time. For a knight in the medieval period, was there any sense of chivalry during warfare, really, or is that mostly a myth?
I think chivalry and chivalric behaviour was an ideal that some people tried to live up to. Probably many people failed. There were rules of behaviour. Some of them were very strict, actually, and you could get into a lot of trouble. So, for example, if you killed a herald of either side, you could be have your nobility stripped from you.
Is that the person who goes around with a trumpet on the battlefield?
Basically, the referee. In medieval battles, you usually had heralds from both sides, people who were literally, who were the ones who were in charge of the heraldry, the identifications. They would identify the dead bodies and who'd been killed and who did what and how.
So you weren't allowed to kill them at all?
No, absolutely. They were representatives of the king. And if you killed a herald, that would be like killing the king. Very strictly obeyed. They were, and heralds got together after the battle to decide who'd won. And often they got to decide the name of the battle as well. Because if you think about it, the battle's fought, and then the heralds are making notes and things and deciding who's done what and how. And then they've got to write it up. They've got to write letters to lots of people, and they've got to call the battle something. So what do they call it?
Please make peace with my presence.
In the game, there's a lot of kind of crying out war cries. In fact, There's a dedicated button to press and you roar a generic kind of battle cry. Is this something that a knight on the battlefield will do, or is that a more rank and file soldier thing?
I think it was very much both. I think there were definite battle cries, but I think they were also used for identification, because on the medieval battlefield, there were no standard uniforms, obviously. There were households. Probably, you know, I'm on the red team is equivalent as you attack somebody who's in blue.
For the blue and gold!
Heraldry came along roughly the same time as people began to wear full face protection. Showing off was an important part. You know, being seen to be brave was an important part of social standing. But if you were the knight with the blue swan on your tabard and you did something, everybody would know that was you.
So in the video game, when I dress up my character in all of their patterns and clothes and painted certain colours, that is something that knights would actually engage in.
Very much so. I think that the modern sort of Hollywood and TV medieval muddy colours is completely and utterly wrong. In fact, I think the medieval period would have been a cacophony of colours, of clashing symbolism and stuff that looks just, to our modern eyes, actually quite dreadful. And bright. Lots of expensive materials, silk, for example, was used extensively, and the materials you used also indicated how wealthy you were. So the brighter the colours, the more expensive your outfit was.
Behold! Greatness approaches!
It was almost like wearing bright colours to say, if I'm in trouble, don't kill me. Just take me.
Yes, literally that. You know, that's the Duke of Lancaster. Don't kill him because he's worth a small fortune. And I do mean a small fortune. Yeah, he would. If you were an ordinary soldier and you captured a duke or something, and your family would be set for life.
What about these speeches that we often see in movies in medieval war scenes where they're giving like a pre-fight rallying speech to rile everyone up? Was that a thing that knights or nobles actually engaged in?
Have you ever tried to listen to somebody giving a speech outdoors when we're all standing around in armour? You basically, everybody's nudging each other, unless you're really close. So you're going, what's he saying? I think that rousing speeches are probably the figment of troubadours' imaginations, partly because they're impractical. If you've got 1,000 people in armour, even if they're standing still, they're going to make a huge amount of noise. Nobody's going to be able to hear it from one end of the 50 yards away. You're not going to hear something, even if they're shouting. But so I think a rousing speech is probably something out of stories.
Seize the moment! Be great! For Agatha! Yeah!
Another thing some of the fighters in games like this do is they turn their sword upside down and they try to kind of hammer people with the hilt. Is that something fighters actually did? Because it feels a bit counterintuitive to hit them with the non-pointy bit.
Yes, you can do it. It's called a Mordhau. It's called a murder stroke. It is a technique. It's a technique we see in the fight books of the time. So it's a historically valid technique. I've tried to do it. You cut your hands. You need to wear mail on your palms, which often armor, you don't have armored palms, but even with gauntlets on. I personally think it's a terrible, terrible technique. A, you can see it coming. B, you know exactly where it's going. C, if it doesn't work, the other side has got the handle of your sword, and it is very, very, I've done it myself. It is super easy to grab that sword and hook it out of their hands.
That one is on me.
In this video game, there's a lot of throwing weapons across mm-hmm. the battlefield. The warriors in the game sometimes just hurl their swords at mm-hmm. one another. There's a knight who flings throwing knives, for example. Were throwing weapons a part of the knight's personal armory?
Probably not really, no. It's actually quite hard to throw things effectively in plate armor. Anyway, and throwing weapons are going to do... Well, swords don't do anything against plate armor for a start. Spears don't really. You need specialist swords or specialist techniques to get through armor at all. So throwing knives are... Well, I'd be annoyed if somebody was chucking knives at me in real life because they could actually cut you. But the chances, they don't really impact very hard. And if somebody's got any kind of thick clothing on whatsoever, you're not going to do a dangerous injury. You might cut them. You might get unlucky and get it in the face or something. But really, you're not going to do much damage at all. You throwing the sword, again, is one of these techniques we see in the fight books from the medieval, the later medieval period. Again, I think sometimes these are flashy last resort moves, which basically you've lost and you might as well chuck your sword and, you know, roll the dice, and if you're lucky, you might win.
It is time to retreat!
You've performed in some reenactment scenes, I think, yes. And you've also, you know, practiced these fighting techniques and stuff. When you see movies and games recreating battles, do the historical inaccuracies like that annoy you, or are you happy to kind of wave it off as a bit of entertainment?
It depends on how entertaining the piece is, and it also depends on the context. So, for example, if it's something like Game of Thrones, which is fantasy, some medieval low fantasy, it's got dragons and giants and the undead in it. So I guess you could say anything goes, but it sort of doesn't as well. Though, for example, one of the things that really gets me when I see jousting, if you don't protect your throat in the joust, you will die from impact. It's as simple as that. Throat and face is incredibly vulnerable. So when I see throat protection missing from actors, or face protection missing, or very big eye slots, I'm thinking, half the time I could get my lance through that eye slot. Does it annoy me? I mean, not really. No, I try not to let it annoy me, but it does sometimes draw me out of the action and the escapism of it.
I surrender!
This game is definitely... It definitely veers towards more unrealistic, over-the-top, purposefully silly kind of stuff. One of the things a player can do in the game, for example, is they can climb into a catapult and basically fire themselves across a map. have you ever seen anyone being catapulted across a field in your time as a battlefield reenactor?
I have. I've seen somebody fall off a horse at speed and travel 10 feet through the air.
But not in an actual catapult, though.
Not in an actual catapult. They were catapulted off a horse and taken to hospital after going 10 feet. So I think the chances of it actually working outside of really silly, cheesy Hollywood movies are impossible. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure somebody's tried it.
Try again! You amuse me!
I'm not excellent at this game that we're talking about, even though I enjoy it. So finally, if you were to give me some fighting tips, tactical pointers, knight to squire, so to speak, what would they be?
Right, are you fighting on foot or on horse?
On foot.
So awareness of your situation around you. There's a chap called Pietro Monte writing in the 15th century, and he says that it is important for a knight to know when to be enraged and when not to be enraged. And he often says it is better to fight when not enraged, but you must know when to become enraged at the right time. It's one of the secrets of being a knight. So I would say situational awareness is the first thing, and then knowing what you're supposed to do and where you're supposed to go would be the next thing to do. And obviously how the controllers work when you're playing a computer game. I often find the controllers are a bit of a nightmare.
So I just need to know when to go full Hulk.
Yes, exactly. When to turn on the beast mode and when not to.
Being strong is never wrong!
And that the tactical side of that is a really important thing in real medieval warfare as well. You know, you can't fight at your maximum exertion for more than a couple of minutes, to be honest. Just look at the professional cage fighters, professional boxers. You know, they all sit down after a while because they can't maintain that level of physicality. And they're the most fit, healthy, real fighters you will ever find. And they can't do it for half an hour at a time. And that must have been the case in the medieval period. So pause sometimes and assess the situation. Don't let the red mist descend continuously.
Jason Kingsley, thank you very much for speaking to us.
My pleasure. Have fun.
You know you're going home on an ox cart, don't you?
That was Jason Kingsley of Rebellion and the Modern History TV YouTube channel. If you want to hear more about that sort of stuff, you can check out that channel on YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's got a whole series of videos on knights and knighthood, the stuff that they did, the food they ate. It's pretty good. But also, you could get an extended version of our chat with Jason by becoming a Hey Lesson patron. For $2 a month, you'll get extended interviews with everybody that we talk to, all the experts. And I will leave the link to that in the description as well. Matt, would you ever do a bit of jousting? Ever get into a bit of a joust?
It sounds terrifying, to be honest. I mean, I can't ride a horse very well. So the idea of riding a horse at someone as they do the same thing, I'm not on board.
No? What if I said you'd definitely get neck protection?
Even then, to be honest, I don't quite understand how satisfactory can neck protection really be in this scenario, right?
I mean, it's better than not having it.
Yeah, but I wonder if people still have very nasty accidents when they're doing this.
I imagine they do. Have you ever tried any like other, I don't know, modern day equivalents to stuff like this, like fencing or sword fighting or archery or anything like that?
I have. I've done a little bit back at uni. There was the Historia Normannis Society that's kind of did similar stuff to our man, reenactments and that. But they did proper fighting, and I never went along to a proper event, but I did go along and just kind of mess around with swords for a bit. Or not swords, sorry, that's a thing. You're not allowed a sword until you're very high ranked in the Victoria Normannis world.
What do you get? It's sticks.
It's like a little short sword, like closer to a dagger.
Oh.
Hmm. But it's still quite fun, until someone came along with a massive staff and fought three of us at once and beat us all up. And that was the point where I stopped.
You know, that feels a little bit like chivalry sometimes, because sometimes in chivalry 2 in the game, you can kind of corner a person in the other team, like three of your own teammates, jabbing at him and slashing and stabbing and throwing things and trying to boot him. And for somehow, he'll be able to fend you all off and just behead each one of you calmly.
Mm. So chivalry's quite generous with this. So you can always be blocking. So as I'll introduce the elephant in the room now, shall I?
Yes.
You can't play chivalry without thinking about Mordhau, at least if you're me. Because I adored Mordhau.
Mordhau is basically this game, but slightly different.
Yes. So Mordhau is this game, but everybody is very deadly and you've got very little health. And to go back to what I was just explaining, the way blocking works is kind of central to how both of those games feel. Because in Mordhau, unless you've got a shield, which generally you don't, you've got to time your blocks very specifically. There's a short window. Whereas in Chivalry, you just hold it down and your stamina will drain, but it's pretty generous with the rate at which that goes down. And not only that, you can also do counterattacks. If you attack as somebody is attacking you and you match the kind of swing that they're doing, as you swing, kind of all attacks that your sword moves through will also get blocked as well, which is why you'll often see somebody surviving for ridiculous lengths of time, even when they've got three or four people battering away at them.
I just think that it being a little bit more welcoming and easy is okay. The blocking thing, for instance, if you're out in the battlefield, you're tearing into someone with a big axe, and they're always blocking. You can see them always blocking. You just move your little forefinger over and you go, "Oh, my friend, I have a kick button." And the kick breaks their block and makes them stumble. It's designed basically to stop turtlers. So you just put the boot in. I think it's well made. I don't want to time my blocks. Get out of here.
I have warmed to it. I think there's a lot to be said for Mordhau's way of doing things, where there's the blocking combined with everybody just having so little health means the scenarios where you do survive in Mordhau when you're outnumbered, you feel more accomplished. The highs in Mordhau are definitely higher when you're just about getting away with something and you have these kind of sudden spurts of stupid lethality that are rare, and you do have to be very good. I will say I've warmed to chivalry a lot. It's less frustrating because, you know, even though I've played so much Mordhau, and before that I played a lot of the first chivalry, this kind of sword fighting's in my blood at this point. But even so, Mordhau is frequently frustrating. You do die so quickly, and you can easily have a lot of lives where it's just run a long way, die, run a long way, die. Whereas chivalry is much nicer about spawning you closer to where the fighting's happening. And because you have so much more health, dying just happens a whole lot less.
Yeah.
You can also argue it kind of evens out the, you know, if you're good in Mordhau, you'll still die a lot because it just comes so quickly and someone can come from behind or whatever. Whereas in chivalry, if you're good, you'll die a little bit, but not much at all.
No. I've seen good players survive for a ridiculously long time. It's frustrating to watch them.
Yeah.
In Chivalry 2, the knight is one of the soldiers that you can play as, but there are other fighters to choose from. There are other classes. Who do you normally prefer to play as?
My favorite, so there's the Vanguard class, and then within that, you've got little sub-classes. And I think the one I like is called the Raider, because they have two primary weapon slots, which means you can go into battle with a big sword and a big hammer, and that means you're free to throw one of those and you'll still have a good backup weapon. But it also means you can kind of switch up what you're using depending on who you're against, because armors, the heavily armored knights, swords aren't as good against them, so you want a big bashing hammer, but then the nippy guys, a sword is best.
I have learned to love the archer class. Now I know what you're
of
thinking.
Of course.
I know what you're thinking, right? Dirty archer trying to kill from afar. What a scumbag. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Fight me normally. But no, it's not the normal archers that I like. It's the javelin thrower. I think he's called the skirmisher.
Mm-hmm.
You get a little shield, smaller than normal shield, and you get these javelins that you can kind of use as stabbing weapons, but also as throwing weapons. I think the idea with them is that you're not supposed to be as far away as an archer normally is. You're supposed to get right in there and then just throw when you can. There's just something almost suicidal that I really enjoy about the javelin throwers.
I do have more respect for that.
Because you don't have a lot of health as an archer, which is fair because you can kill people from like 20 meters away. So
We should say it's not just me. Archers are kind of widely reviled in these games because, I mean, you know, kind of for fair reason, you're in the middle of these intimate mental back and forths as you're blocking and parrying and trying to sneak in a blow, and it's all kind of, you know, chivalric, I guess. And then some from the back of the map just shoots you. It's like, oh, okay.
There are other like non-chivalric things you can do. Like you put down a bear trap at the top of a little ramp or something, and someone will get up the ramp and think, aha, I've climbed your walls. And you think, no, you're about to go in the bear trap, buddy.
There's still an element of, you know, if I walk into a bear trap, it's like, well, I could have looked at the bear trap, I guess. But being shot at when you're trying to fight someone, it's just, you can't do anything other than run away. Or run at them.
You run at them, don't you? Yeah. That's how you deal with the archers, is that you just close the gap. You do a little, it's like, great, funny slalom towards them.
I will say, I hate being shot at by archers, but charging towards archers and the Vanguard gets a special sprint attack is one of the best things in the game. Because there always comes a point where the archer just knows that they're doomed. Like, once you get within a certain range, it's like, you're not going to miss. They still have their bow out, so they can't block. and they have little health, so you're just going to get them in one or two swings.
Yeah.
It's very satisfying.
I was talking to Jason about this idea of chivalry, like valor on the battlefield. Have you had any encounters in Chivalry 2 where your opponent was maybe more honourable than expected?
I don't know about that. I don't know if I've had anyone spare me, but I have had moments where me and somebody have, for whatever reason, maybe he's done an emote rather than fighting me. And if somebody does that, if somebody, you know, says, oh, hello, and waves, I'll be inclined to stop stabbing them and wave and say hello back. And sometimes that'll happen in a little corner of a map. And I do remember one time where this guy on the enemy team had kind of gotten stranded in this little nook, and my team had pushed forward. But we'd kind of made friends at this point and been waving back and forth and saying various silly things. There's kind of a nice little extensive voice command system you can use. So I protected him for a while and just kind of stood in front of him, and nobody could get around me, just saying no and shaking my finger at anyone that tried to get him.
He's a prisoner of war. You can't kill him.
Yeah. He's a captured noble.
I frequently spare people, because there's a thing where if you can down people and they kind of like fall down, and if you imagine in other shooter games like Apex Legends or something like that, where you're downed but you're not out, you're kind of crawling around on the ground, you can be revived and stuff like that. Mm. That happens in Chivalry 2. And every once in a while, if I've had a really good fight with someone and I down them instead of killing them, and they don't do the immediate thing, which a lot of people do when they're downed, which is just try to, because you can kind of take a swing at people's ankles in Chivalry 2.
If you land, you ankle swipes, you get back up.
Yeah, yeah. If they don't do that, if they're just kind of like waiting, or like, you know, waiting for the final blow, I'll kind of step back and I'll say something on the voicemail, and then I'll just walk away. They might bleed out. They might not. They might get killed by somebody else on my team who wants to go for them. But in certain circumstances, I will not deliver the coup de grace. I'll just be like, no, I won't stoop to that.
That's very honourable. These are the words of a man that does not care about gaining the little plus 50 points that comes out of people's heads when you stab them on the ground.
The only thing you can get with XP in Chivalry 2 really is like new cosmetic stuff. You can unlock new classes and stuff like that, so that's useful. But once you've got every class, really, or all the ones you kind of like, points and XP become completely nothing to me.
But what about the scoreboard, Brendy?
There's always going to be like 10, 20 people better than me on the scoreboard, so it doesn't really bother me to not get 50 from beheading that per downed person. Like I say, I only do it once in a while. I'm not like a saint.
This is a thing, actually, because I do sometimes get to the top of the scoreboard, but that gives me proper like scoreboard anxiety, where I'm constantly thinking, oh, are other people going to do better than me? I've got to, you know, and then you'll die, and there'll be this long run to the front line as you check this, a kind of long run to the front line as you check the scoreboard to see people inching your way towards you. And it's not pure vanity, because on some of the maps, if you're the top scoring player, you get to become the special dude who might be like, you know, the heir or the duke, which you kind of become a person with you are physically massive and you have a big health pool and a big sword, but the other team has to kill you before the timer runs out, and that's, you know, the dramatic last stand. And actually being that person feels great.
That's far more meritocratic than medieval battlefields would have been, I guess. You got to be the duke just by dint of being a good soldier. But like, as Jason was telling us, you can only get knighted by another knight or the king, I guess.
Or a vampire.
Or a vampire, yeah. And you have to be born into it, almost. That protect the duke or kill the duke thing is like one of the objectives in an objective-led match. But there are other matches like the death matches, or there's like really quick death matches that happen in a Roman gladiatorial arena style place.
With lots of pits you can push people into and spikes.
Yeah, so what is your favorite incidental map detail or favorite place to have a fight?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, I quite like the dynamic of there's an objective where you've got to free prisoners from cages, and they're kind of scattered around. So the enemy team will run up to them and kind of desperately hack away at these cages as you try and stop them. And every now and then they'll try and turn around and sneak in a cheeky little stab on this poor little caged slave. Well, they're trying to just hack them free from the cages.
That's right, yeah.
And then actually once they're free from the cages, what were protecting them can then kill them for extra points. I don't know why.
I don't know why they even like bother, but I mean it's fun. They do have these bots as well, like the same kind of peasant bots that are roaming around in other maps. There's one map where the attacking team has to steal gold. It's stockpiled in like a town center. Normally they're stored on carts and you have to take them from one cart to another to kind of steal them. But there are also some bot peasants walking around in a very robotic manner.
Yeah.
But they've got gold in their arms, so you can go up and kill a peasant and steal their gold.
Also on that map, I think you start off as peasants, like in the initial...
Yeah, if you're defending, yeah.
As the map opens, you're just some peasants in the field and all of these armed soldiers just come pouring out of the forest and you stand no chance. Except there is a video of a man called Trix, I think his name is, where he just survives for the entire game as a peasant.
Really? I'm going to try and find that and link to it because that sounds excellent.
He does have someone following around throwing medkits at him.
I mean, still.
It's still pretty
impressive. Jason also spoke about heraldry, and if you're on a battlefield, you'll wear gilded armor and stuff like that. Have you dressed up your characters a lot? Like, how have you uniformed them?
It's just a lot of gold, really, I think.
So we're capturing you on the battlefield, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I've got like a slightly golden helmet. I'd rather not have a helmet in a way, so you can see my face. But I reason, the way the characters look, right? You can kind of dress up the classes with less health to look like they're knights that are beefier. Which, in my mind, gives me a subtle advantage.
That's such a min-maxy,
I know,
competitive battler kind of mentality.
And yet, when I think about what I do, right? Like, if somebody's running around helmetless, it's partly a trained thing from Mordhau, right? Where a single headshot on a headless person would just kill them instantly. And I wonder if that is ingrained in other people as well. Where if I'm fighting multiple people, I will absolutely prioritize the squishiest looking one.
You see, I try to psych people out in a very old fashioned battler way. I have my characters, usually I try to just make them as scary looking as possible, like as intimidating as possible. My javelin thrower is this horrible scarred lady, like with a white eye. She doesn't wear a helmet at all because why would you need a helmet? She's invincible. She's got this Viking berserker haircut, face paint, downer face, like big red stripes, a big octopus emblem on her shirt because you get different animals that you can put as emblems on your shirt. And I just decided, what's the freakiest animal? Like, what's an animal, if it came at you, you'd freak out the most? And, you know, there were lions, there are bears and stuff like that. And then there was a big octopus. And I thought, do you know what? There's something almost toxic looking about someone wearing a big octopus on their shirt.
I have a lot of respect for that. The other thing is you can sometimes tell who the really good players are because they're the ones, you know, that are decked out in very fancy gold livery that you only get after you've played for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, that is intimidating.
Well, I think they should be nerds about it like me because... Absolutely. If I'm about to fight somebody and I can see they're dressed in gold, I will calibrate differently, right? I'll know, like, oh, I can't go for basic stuff. I'm going to have to be tricksy. I know they're particularly deadly. Whereas if I'm just fighting a normal person, I generally won't put that much thought into it. They've tipped me off, you know, because they feel the need to show off.
What I'm doing is I'm a bad player trying to project strength and you're a good player trying to project weakness.
I haven't actually done this, but sometimes you get bots in the game and they're always dressed the same way. You
try to pretend to be a bot.
I'm sure it would work. I'm sure there would be times when people would absolutely think, oh, that's just a bot. I can do whatever. And then cut them down. I haven't actually gone that far though.
All the bots in Chivalry 2, you can tell who they are mostly because they have a single name and it's always a very plain name, like Stanley, David, or like, you know, stuff like this. So you'd have to give yourself a really plain name.
I think I did see one other person doing this.
If you went with Mateus, you could probably get away with it.
I kind of want to do it just for science, you know, just see what the impact is. I wonder if people ever did this on real battlefields.
Don't kill me, I'm a bot. All right, that's all we have time for.
Oh my goodness.
It just flies by. This has been another episode of Hey Lesson with me, Brendan Caldwell, and the murderous Matt Cox.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. It's always good to have you on. You're like my go-to man. If you're listening out there and you want more Matt in your lives, for example, you can get him on our monthly bonus episodes, which you'll get if you subscribe to the Hey Lesson Patreon. You're on so many of them. Like, to the point where I go to you on Discord and I type, "Hey Matt," and you instantly reply with "Yes" in all caps because you know I'm about to ask you to come on the show.
It's true. I'm old reliable.
So like I say, the link to that is in the Patreon. The link to that Patreon is in the show notes. And you can get extra goodies like those bonus episodes. You might get update videos, but more importantly, you get to listen to the longer unabridged interviews with all of the biologists, archaeologists, interior decorators, space experts, caving instructors, everyone, all the clever people that we interview. There's basically a small library of fun interviews at this point. So just head to patreon.com/heylesson or heylesson.net to find out more. A big thank you to all our current patrons, a genteel bow and a nod of the head to a few of our most chivalrous supporters, the gallant Bok Choi, the valiant Herenda Monas, and the ever honorable Milk is Gross and Bad for You. Until next time, we'll see you all later. Thank you again. One final thanks to Matt.
Thank you.
And we'll see you later. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening.